The following podcast is sponsored by Financial Sense Wealth Management. To learn more about our investment services, go to financialsense.com or give us a call at 888-486-3939.
U.S. stocks ended lower on Friday as disappointing earnings from Snap spooked investors and shares in social media and ad tech firms dropped. Still, all three major indexes posted weekly gains despite Friday's losses. Meta and Alphabet are set to post their earnings next week, along with mega-cap peers including Apple, Microsoft, and Amazon.com. All eyes are on the Federal Reserve's meeting and second quarter U.S. gross domestic product data next week. While the U.S. Central Bank is expected to raise interest rates by 75 basis points to curb runaway inflation, the GDP data is likely to be negative again.
So now next week, you've got four of the five largest tech companies. Every one of these companies is telling us they are doing hiring pauses or hiring freezes, or they're withdrawing offers in some cases. We know what that's a prelude to. And that's what I will reserve judgment until we get through those earnings reports and those outlooks and those reactions. And maybe I'll change my tune, but I'm telling you right now, a lot of the negatives are not yet in the earnings themselves. They may be in the multiple contraction, but are not yet in the earnings. And that's what I think we have to be concerned about.
The situation we find ourselves in, I would say, consists of four different groups. One group is the activists. I mean, those are the people who really believe that the end of the world is around the corner. Then you have the governments and politicians. And what they do is they like to virtue signal to those people because they believe that they represent a huge chunk of the population. And then you have companies who want to make a profit off of it. So you have a kind of a Bermuda Triangle of ideology that consists of those three groups. And the quote-unquote working class, they're trapped in this because it's more and more encroaching on their daily lives. They realize now that they accepted the eccentric ideas of their elites to the extent that they did not believe that it will have a negative effect on their life. But now they see this negative effect.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team.
The first signs of an approaching recession are starting to emerge, with the S&P Global Composite PMI contracting last month from 52.3 to a recessionary reading of 47, while the manufacturing index also dropped to a two-year low. A reading below 50 indicates the economy is contracting. Meanwhile, inflation continues unabated, with the producer price index expanding by 11% last month, indicating there's more inflation building into the pipeline. Bond yields on treasuries have been falling, reflecting a weakening economy. We're starting to see more of that as more companies begin layoffs. Inflation is also heating up elsewhere in Europe, and the continent is racked by high inflation as natural gas and oil prices rise to levels never seen before, and now there's talk of famine and energy shortages ahead of this year's winter. Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplavin. Welcome to a special edition of the NewsHour. Joining me on the show will be Doomberg in an extended interview as we discuss the present energy crisis, which is not going away anytime soon, due to lack of investment, ESG, and government energy policy, which is only driving energy prices higher. And following Doomberg will be my interview with Mish Snyder from MarketGage. She joins us as she looks at a short-term rally in stocks, and you're going to want to know why Mish is buying copper, gold, and energy.
It was an interesting week on Wall Street. In the face of negative economic news, the market rallied this week on short covering better than expected earnings news, and with the knowledge that maybe investors have been too bearish for existing conditions. Tuesday, the Bank of America's Global Fund Managing Survey showed that equity allocations are at their lowest level since the financial crisis in 2008, and the highest cash level since 2001. The idea is, if everybody has sold, there's nobody left to sell, and it was a contrarian support catalyst that's been driving some of the accumulation this week in stocks. FactSet shows that recent energy company earnings released have helped to prop up the earnings estimates for the second quarter. Last week, I reported that the blended growth rate between companies that have reported and are yet to report, so their estimates combined with actual results, was at 4.1%, And because of those earnings from energy companies, it's gone up to about 4.8% growth. However, according to FactSet, that still reflects a growth rate that's the slowest since the fourth quarter of 2020. Earnings growth for the energy sector is forecasted to be up 265%, according to FactSet, while earnings are expected to be down about 9.7% for utilities, down about 10% for communication services, down 11% for consumer discretion, and down 25% for financials. Revenue results have been good, but those aren't adjusted for inflation, so I'm mainly focusing on earnings, which also include costs that have been influenced by, there it is, inflation. Looking at some of the earnings highlights, three airlines have posted thus far, United Airlines, Delta Airlines, and American Airlines over the past 2 weeks. Reactions to their earnings were negative despite strong demand and obviously humongous prices that anybody traveling has realized. American noted that their domestic leisure travel demand has surpassed 2019 levels in the second quarter, with improvement in corporate and international travel there as well. Unfortunately, the industry is understaffed, undertrained, and unable to increase capacity with more flight cancellations this year than in all of 2021. The issues also lie with staffing issues for control towers that are unable to keep up with however many flights have been appearing. Additionally, United's CEO Scott Kirby warned that the economy may slow, potentially ending or slowing the recent flux of demand. The communications sector had a bummer of a week, despite some positive reactions to Netflix's earnings. Netflix announced it will have an ad-supported price tier and gave news that it will allow additional homes to be added to accounts to, I guess, crack down on account sharing. On the downside this week, earnings from AT&T and Verizon were combined with negative investor reactions in Alphabet and Meta platforms as a result of a drop in Snap's stock as a result of earnings on Friday. And that led to the entire sector's performance down 1.2% for the week. While Snap gave weak guidance in late May, the company refrained from providing guidance in the third quarter due to uncertainties, but that its flat year-over-year results are in revenue. Revenue was up 13% in the quarter versus 38% growth in the prior quarter, Q1. Daily average users growth is falling and the company is burning through its cash reserves. The company said Apple's operating system privacy changes have had a lasting effect on the value of ads. The drop in Snap combined with its inferred effects on other companies is what was attributed as dropping stocks on Friday. The best performing sector this week was consumer discretionary, which had a lot of assistance from Tesla's better than feared report and reaction to its earnings. Office Depot had announced a $600 million share buyback program with half hitting the market through a Dutch auction tender offer and feels earnings should improve this year by 55% over last. The Philadelphia Semiconductor Index did well this week, up 5.5% on reports a bill will provide about $52 billion for the industry that may pass the Senate next week. Moving on to economics, the NAHB's housing market index fell to 55 from 67, its biggest monthly drop since April of 2020. June housing starts and separately existing home sales were also weaker. Initial claims topped 250,000 for the first time since the middle of November of last year, and the July Philadelphia Fed index fell to a negative 12.3 from negative 3.3 due mainly to the new orders index, which is a leading component. The June leading economic indicators were negative 0.8%, which prompted the conference board to suggest a U.S. recession is very likely at the end of this year or beginning part of 2023. Finally, the IHS Market Manufacturing Survey slipped to 52.3 from 52.7, and the services PMI dropped to 47 from 52.7, which marks a contraction now, anything below 50. The deteriorating economic outlook helped drop the two-year note to close this week at 2.99%, down 14 basis points, and the 10-year note yield to fall 15 basis points to 2.78%, still inverted between the two. Finally, this week, the ECB raised rates 50 basis points instead of the expected 25 basis points, and the Bank of Japan left theirs alone, still negative 0.10%. 175 S&P 500 companies are scheduled to announce next week, which will really kick off the earnings season, and there will also be 12 Dow components, so earnings still in the limelight. Up next, Jim with a combined special guest and big picture segment with Doomberg.
I think the sell-off in the first half of the year was primarily about the contraction of the earnings multiple. Now, I would say that I think we're probably more or less through with this phase of the multiple contracting. So I would say story of the second half of the year is the next shoe to drop in terms of determining the fate of the stock market is going to be the trajectory of earnings and earnings expectations. Now, if I'm correct, I would expect earnings to disappoint, forward expectations of earnings to get marked quite substantially lower, and that to catalyze another leg lower in the market.
To listen to this full interview, in addition to gaining access to all of our premium content airing during the week, go to financialsense.com and hit the subscribe button.
At Financial Sense Wealth Management, we are committed to helping you build, maintain, and preserve your wealth. Contact us today to find out about our comprehensive financial planning and asset management services. Whether you're planning for retirement, taxes, putting together an estate plan, or need assistance in managing a 401k, Financial Sense Wealth Management is here to help. Give us a call to speak with one of our certified financial planners or wealth advisors at 888-486-3939 or go to financialsense.com and hit where it says Contact Us. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors, Inc., a registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities, Inc., member FINRA SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
Well, we got a lot to discuss today. What's going on in the markets, especially the energy markets? Joining us on the program are the folks from Doomberg. And I want to start out, I guess my first question is, 1 year ago, we were at $40, $50 oil, and then we got almost up to $120. How did we get here? It seems to me it's been a confluence of events from lack of investment, geopolitical, to political policy. What's your take here?
Yeah, it's a combination of factors. I would say those things that you mentioned and the disruptions from the negative $37 a barrel oil price shortly after the response to the COVID pandemic caused, you know, there to be so much excess supply that we had run out of storage. And so if I were to sort of put it into three buckets, I would say that there's no question that in the past half a dozen years, we've seen an underinvestment in the commodity cycle. This is driven in large part by a combination of ESG pressures and the defund of fossil fuel movement. It's undeniable that a lot of capital was destroyed in the shale patch. And so the companies that filed for bankruptcy in the aftermath of the COVID shutdowns and that have since reemerged have a sense of discipline about them that has been taught to them by their negative experience during the pandemic. There's also no question that we have a geopolitical premium baked into the price of oil. The Biden administration has been signaling conflicting messages, and that has caused, I think, a substantial risk premium to be baked in as well. And then, of course, the demand has recovered much faster than perhaps planners in the sector had anticipated. So it's those three things that are driving the price, in our view.
One thing that really strikes me is the policies, and you've written about some of these green policies, whether it's ESG or climate change, and wherever it's been adopted. I wonder if you might tell the Sri Lanka story where they went from self-sufficiency to importing and basically starvation in a year.
Yeah, the Sri Lanka story we told in a piece called Running from Empty. As a warning, a potential negative foreshadowing of what may transpire in Germany, depending on how the current acute gas shortage and energy shortage in general plays out in Western Europe. So Sri Lanka is a tale of many fallacies and challenges. Predominantly, they embarked on an experiment in organic farming at a rate that I think was unsustainable and unachievable. And at one point, the leadership of Sri Lanka put an import ban on synthetic fertilizers. and the speed of that conversion, which was cheered on by the ESG crowd. They had like the highest ESG rating in the world and were written up favorably by the World Economic Forum as a poster child for how to get your ESG strategy right. And then because of these mistakes, which we characterize as essentially flubbing their energy policy, because fertilizer and food are just derivatives of energy, literally in one season, the country has collapsed. And it's really shocking to see. You know, we opened the piece by saying, until quite recently, Sri Lanka was a pretty good country. It had a GDP per capita twice that of India and 35% higher than Ukraine, just, you know, to give people some context. And now there's, you know, riots in the streets. They have a complete shortage of energy. They're reliant upon international aid. And it's unclear how this country is going to get put back together in the near term. And we wrote that opening story for this piece, running from MD, because if you zoom out a little bit, Germany and by extension Western Europe is in a pretty precarious place, and the speed with which a country like Sri Lanka collapsed should be a warning. And we do say, obviously, Germany has more buffer between itself and the abyss than Sri Lanka did, but it's still a pretty scary story.
Yeah, and you're seeing it not just in Sri Lanka, you're seeing it in Germany, now Norway, and also in my own state of California, where we've been going through brownouts all summer. And the state is trying to push this green agenda. For example, in I think it's 2035, you can't buy combustion engine cars. Diesel trucks will not be allowed in the state by 2030. But it seems like they're not thinking through, okay, if we're going to go in that direction, then why are we converting stable forms of electricity? Because it takes a lot to charge your Tesla at night, to unstable forms. In fact, the president came out yesterday and said the answer to the crisis is wind farms.
So we would categorize California as New Germany. That's a nickname that we've given it. It's unclear to us why it is that the leadership of California feels the need to replicate an experiment that has already been played out in full course in Germany. Germany is one of the leading countries for the installation of wind and solar. They have spent almost $500 billion, I believe is the number, on their transition. And they've cut their fossil fuel consumption by something like 5 or 6%. These renewables, by and large, are intermittent and require excess baseload capacity to allow them to participate in the grid. Those costs are never included in the sort of marketing campaign for why we should switch. And nor, I would say, and we would argue, are the energy costs to produce these things in the first place. You know, the amount of steel and epoxy that go into a windmill, for example, make the energy payback period, you know, it's measured in years, whereas a nuclear power plant, which California seems hell-bent on closing all of them with only one remaining in Diablo Canyon, the energy payback period on nuclear power is 6 weeks. And so it's baffling. Germany has, before Russia invaded Ukraine, amongst the highest electricity and energy prices in the world. And obviously that gave all of the leverage to Putin to move on Ukraine. And he took that leverage and he moved on Ukraine. It's unclear to me why California seems hell-bent on repeating that experiment. The only solution, of course, is political and a replacement of the political leaders who put California in that spot, but that does not seem on the horizon.
No, in fact, we tried to recall the governor and he won handedly, so he's continuing with those policies. But it's also being applied. We're seeing it, whether it's, you know, Indonesia, we're seeing it in Europe, we're seeing it in the U.S., we're seeing it in Canada. And I wonder if you might take some time and explain, we live in a fossil fuel world. I mean, it takes jet fuel to put a 787 Dreamliner in the sky, or diesel fuel to fill a container ship to bring goods and transport them around the world, not to mention, you know, everything that we buy in a store got there by a truck.
Yeah, so the way we think about the world, and I'm sure this is very similar to the way you do, is energy is life, and the amount of energy you get to use defines your standard of living. And all people everywhere would like a higher standard of living. That's sort of the human endeavor, which is a constant, unrelenting struggle against the forces of entropy. And so we define energy profit as the amount of excess primary energy a society might produce in a given time period. And then that excess profit defines the aggregate amount of standard of living you can distribute to your people. And you hope so. You hope that that is done in a equitable way, in an efficient way. So if you look at the energy profit from that scenario, let's just imagine, I'll just pick a number. It takes 2 years for a solar firm to pay back its energy, you know, you have to put that energy in up front. There's an enormous amount of energy that goes into making polysilicon, which then is, you know, sliced into wafers and assembled onto modules and so on. That energy has to come from somewhere. And so you can't just create solar cells out of whole cloth. Like you say, the materials have to be mined and processed. And so the energy payback period on oil and gas is, of course, quite rapid, because once you drill the well, it's just an enormous amount of useful energy coming out. Now, having said that, if your desire as a society is to optimize the ratio of the increase in standard of living we can give people divided by the amount of carbon emissions, then you would prioritize where you would burn fossil fuels, like in trucks, delivery trucks and mining trucks. And if you had a huge investment in nuclear power, then doing things like converting the automotive fleet to, say, plug-in hybrid electric vehicles versus full battery electric might begin to make more sense. But right now, you are crimping the supply of fossil fuels, and you're also shutting down nuclear power. You are incentivizing the purchase of electric vehicles, which needs to get charged. And since wind and power are intermittent, they destabilize an electricity grid once they get above a certain percentage. And so then you're left with the worst of all worlds. You have rolling blackouts. You have an inability to charge your electric vehicles, and your economy collapses. If we stopped the development of fossil fuels today, the number of people in the world who would starve would be measured in billions. And so if you are anti-fossil fuel and anti-nuclear, ultimately, you're anti-human.
Couldn't have said it more plainly. I want to talk about something else that's coming out. The president found this when he went to the G7. Macron said, hey, Saudi Arabia and Kuwait can't produce more than 150,000. One of the things that always struck me about Saudi Arabia is in the 80s, towards the end of the 80s, all these countries revalued all their reserves. They doubled, some cases tripled, without any known discoveries based on their productions. In Saudi Arabia, it has been at $260 billion in reserves. They've been producing about 3% of their reserves every year. It never goes down. And their answer is, well, we just find and replace what it is. And I doubt very seriously if they can get to 12.5 million barrels of production. They can barely do 10. And I just don't see the reserves being there. When is the market going to wake up to that fact?
So I would draw a distinction between reserves and production capacity, and I'll give my answer in both parts. So with respect to reserves, reserves are an interesting accounting calculation that depends heavily upon management judgment around how technology is evolving. And you know, if you have a breakthrough, say, for example, in horizontal drilling like we did in the shale patch, resources can become reserves pretty quickly because suddenly they are technically feasible. So the fact that their stated total reserves roughly keeps up with their annual extraction from those reserves is less surprising to me than it might be to others. Having said that, their ability to produce is a whole separate question. And that involves a lot of politics and a huge amount of investment. And people may be choosing to not invest as much as they would with the understanding that these are inelastic materials. And why flood the market to make oil cheap when you have a finite amount of it and you want to optimize the integral of the amount of dollars you can extract from the importer countries for doing so? And so today they state that their production capacity is around 12 million barrels a day. Saudi, again, I would hold separate from the rest of OPEC and OPEC Plus. The Saudi Arabians and Saudi Aramco in particular are extraordinarily technically advanced, very sophisticated, often underestimated in the Western culture. They are amongst the most technically sophisticated companies in the world. Their production capacity is a political choice plus an investment decision. OPEC Plus, the rest of OPEC, is a different story. We doubt, and many others have doubted, the excess capacity as stated. And so that's sort of a long answer, but I would separate reserves from production, and then I would separate Saudi from OPEC Plus.
So if we take a look at what's happened with oil production, probably most of the increase we've seen in oil production has been from the U.S. shale patch, especially over the last decade. What's your take on shale? And many people are saying that shale has probably peaked in the U.S. You know, I'm not a geologist, so I'm not an expert. But what's your take on shale? And can we realistically make up that difference with shale?
Yeah, so great question. And it's one of the most important questions the market is pondering. So if we just zoom out and look at the five-year chart of the U.S. production of oil in barrels per day, peaked out just before COVID at 13 million barrels a day. And that is really an incredible achievement, a technology miracle. Post-COVID, it bottomed out, you know, around, bounced back and forth, but mostly around 11 million barrels a day. And, you know, 2 years past that event, we are still not all the way back to 13. We are struggling to get back to 12 million barrels a day of production. And that's in part because there's this phenomenon called drilled and uncompleted wells. So what happened after COVID, because of this investor desire for a financial return and a newfound discipline amongst the oil producers in the shale patch, they have been harvesting previously drilled wells because it's sort of two steps, you drill them and then you complete them. Because you could think of those as sort of the inventory of easily accessible oil. Now, the big question that everyone in the market is trying to understand is, are we going to top out at 12 million barrels a day and maybe even roll over because we're not doing as much drilling as we should be, in part because of the political landscape and the challenges thereof? Or will we continue to climb back up to 13 million barrels a day and beyond? That's the big question. Our view is it will be hard, based on the drilling data, to get substantially higher production out of the U.S. industry in a time frame that matters both politically and for the near-term price of oil and gas at the pump.
In your opinion, at least this is my opinion, that we're heading for an energy crisis, because even if we were to see capital come back into the industry, you and I know it takes time to find and explore and bring oil into production. But in the meantime, we're making it more difficult to bring oil into production. Companies have been starved of capital. And, you know, I just think of like our own country. A year ago, they were dragging the oil executives before Congress, asking them to divest themselves of their assets. And then a year later, we're dragging them before Congress, asking them to produce more. So if you were an oil executive, given the anti-fossil fuel rhetoric that we're seeing coming from our politicians, what would give you the incentive to start investing? I just don't see it.
Yeah, that's a very good point and something that we've written about. And to your question about will we have an energy crisis, I would say that we're in the middle of an energy crisis globally. And it's just a matter of how and when the true impacts of that global crisis, you know, that wave hits our shores. Right now, the main action in the energy crisis is in Europe. Although today, and we're recording this on Thursday, today they did get a bit of a reprieve as Putin did reopen the Nord Stream 1 natural gas pipeline. There were some fears in the market that he might not. But even with that reprieve, Jim, I'm pulling up the price of natural gas in Europe as we speak. The price of natural gas in Europe is approximately $280 a barrel oil equivalent. So if you look at the energy in natural gas, said another way, the price of natural gas in Europe is six times what we're paying in the US. And this is devastating European manufacturing. And so that energy crisis in Europe has leaked into Asia. The $40 a million BTU for LNG going to Asia today, roughly. Coal prices are at all-time highs. I think thermal coal reached $500. I'll pull it up as we're talking on my handy Bloomberg here. Newcastle coal out of Australia right now is at $408 a ton, which compares to, you know, less than $100 a ton in the past 5 years at some points. And so it bottomed out at $50 a ton in 2020, and then now it's up eightfold. You know, when you're talking multiple hundreds of percent price increase in straight lines up like this, this is an energy crisis. The real question is, per your question, a comment you alluded to earlier, is when do we see demand destruction and an economic recession / depression because of this? Because this is what happened in 2008. Oil peaked out at 147, and 3 months later, we had the global financial crisis.
So when you look at this, what I find hard to follow is, let's take Germany. They're shutting down their nuclear power plants, but then they're going to restart their coal fire plants. In the U.S., we're shutting down more nuclear power plants than we're building new ones. And, you know, if you're green, you're concerned about climate change, why wouldn't you be building more than less?
The professional environmental movement has a bizarre hatred of nuclear power. Many people have speculated as to the genesis of that hatred. I would characterize it as bizarre and unhuman. You cannot decarbonize the economy without a substantial renaissance of nuclear power. It's just physically impossible. The laws of physics forbid it. You can't just literally can't do it without massive starvation, huge drops in standard of living and on the path from abundance to starvation is riot. And so we shall see substantial political upheaval. So for example, back to our friends in Europe and Germany in particular, we fear a substantial rightward tilt in the politics of Western Europe. People won't take energy blunders and the subsequent crushing of their standard of living peacefully. We will see radical governments. We will see revolutions. We will see substantial political upheavals. And that's next. So their policy is insane. Their policy is plainly insane, provably insane. And their response thus far, as you mentioned, restarting coal plants out of crisis and then still continuing to be opposed to nuclear power and doubling down on the same policies that put them here, seems to be a reflection of a politician's inability to admit a mistake and try to correct it. And until we have a broad consensus of how we got here, it's unclear that we'll have the political fortitude to get us out.
You know, the other thing that strikes me about the green movement, okay, so if you want to build EVs, you need copper. But we vetoed every new copper mine. Like in the U.S., you're seeing it elsewhere. So you can't have green without strategic materials, whether it's silver, whether it's copper, it's cobalt, it's lithium, all those things we need, but we need to have those mines. And the thing that really strikes me here is if you question any of these policies, for example, in Germany, you're called a climate denier. In fact, they're trying to suppress anybody that would question this or have alternative points of view or facts.
Yeah, so this is the fallacy, of course. It's not just copper. Like you mentioned, it's nickel and lithium and cobalt. Cobalt is mined in terrible conditions in Congo, and it makes no sense. Like this is back to the point earlier, the physics deny it. Like not only do we not approve of the new mines, but we export it to the very same countries that will be first in line for political upheaval. When the food crisis that's flowing from this finds its way to their shores. And so just look at Peru, for example. They had food riots earlier this year. Peru is a home to tons of copper mines and some of the biggest mines in the world. Same with Chile. We will not do the things necessary to achieve the stated strategy, which itself is silly. This is what happens when you have people in politics who have no industrial experience whatsoever, and they bathe themselves in platitudes and they make themselves feel good at cocktail parties, but they have no earthly idea what they're talking about in the real world. And it's only a matter of time before the adults take the steering wheel back. It's just a matter of the amount of pain we have to suffer collectively as a society before that happens.
You know, another issue that is a major concern, especially here in the U.S., we're drawing down our strategic petroleum reserves to the tune of 1 million barrels a day leading up to the midterm elections. By the time they're done, we're going to go through half of those, leaving us very vulnerable. For example, we're in the midst of a hurricane season. Should a hurricane shut down production in the Gulf, or who knows, another war like the Ukraine breakout that disrupts oil supplies, leaves us very vulnerable. And much of that oil was bought at lower prices. If we have to replace it, we're going to pay a hell of a lot more to do that.
Yes. So the release of the strategic petroleum reserves is a political decision. We're not in a national emergency. In fact, price at the pump in the U.S. for all of its elevated status from our perspective is still globally relatively cheap. Europeans are paying 80 to 100% more than we are per gallon. Having said that, the real crisis is in the refining sector, at least in North America, which is a piece we wrote about called Grim Diesel. We have not built a new refinery in the U.S. since 1977 of major size. We've built some small ones. And so our refining capacity has basically been static for 40 years. And the sort of mini scandal around the fact that the oil we're releasing is finding its way to China doesn't surprise us, because that's where the excess refining capacity exists today. Our refiners in the U.S. are running at 95% capacity, which if you have any experience in industry, you realize that this is, running full throttle, pedal to the metal. And at these levels, it's only a matter of time before one of them breaks. And so the real fear from our perspective, vis-a-vis hurricane season, is not taking out production, although that would be bad. It's taking out refining capacity.
And much of that is along the Gulf Coast as well. I want to get into the inflationary aspects as well as the importance of things like natural gas for food production and fertilizers. So we think of natural gas, you know, probably in Europe right now, they're thinking, how are we going to heat our homes during the winter? But let's talk about the implications for food production.
Yeah, so natural gas is a key input into the production of ammonia. And so and ammonia is one of the three critical fertilizers that are needed to effectively and efficiently increase crop yields. And alternatively as well, diesel is a big input into mining, as you mentioned, and potash and so on are mined. Phosphate is mined. So between the potassium from potash and the phosphate, you know, the phosphorus from phosphate mines, and then ammonia synthesized via the Haber process using natural gas as a feedstock, there you have it. I mean, without fertilizer, you end up like Sri Lanka. And so having said that, of course, this does create huge advantages for U.S.-based producers of fertilizer because they get to pay the relatively cheap natural gas prices here. They can export their products at global prices. And so there are some companies that are benefiting greatly. Any manufacturer that relies on natural gas is printing cash today in the U.S. because they have access to cheap natural gas here that's kind of stranded. And maybe we could chat about the unique nature of the natural gas market and why we see such price differentials around the world. But the European and Asian natural gas prices has been very beneficial to the small subset of manufacturers who still make stuff in America and require natural gas as a key input.
Yeah, let's move into the area of natural gas because, you know, most people think we're using natural gas now because of the heat wave in California, which is another reason we're having some of these power outs. But its role in so many issues, as you mentioned, with food production and what that might imply for starvation.
Yeah, so natural gas is critical. Natural gas is unique in the sense that it can be readily burned and cleanly burned for heat in the home. It can be burned in the kitchen, you know, for cooking. It is an incredibly important precursor to many chemical products like fertilizers and others. And also it is used at very large manufacturing sites like this piece we wrote, Moorbund Verbund, that talked about the BASF super site in Ludwigshafen, Germany. Natural gas powers these cogeneration plants that make both electricity and industrial grade steam. And, you know, if Putin had shut off the natural gas, and luckily, knock on wood, it looks like he hasn't, at least yet, that could jeopardize sites like that in a very quick way. And then that just throws a monkey wrench into all manner of supply chains that require these, you know, front of supply chain type chemical goods and allow us to enjoy the standard of living that we've become accustomed to. So natural gas is unique, but also natural gas is challenging to transport because it is gas. And unlike oil, which is a liquid, and coal, which is the easiest to ship because it's a solid, natural gas is very, very difficult to ship. And because of that, we have these giant LNG carriers. And what happens is that these export facilities, LNG export facilities, we freeze natural gas and turn it into a liquid. We cool it, I should say, and turn it into a liquid. We don't freeze it all the way to a solid. And we put it on these giant boats. And then those boats become floating arbitrages for arbitrageurs for natural gas. And the U.S. has an abundance of natural gas. The rest of the world has a shortage of natural gas. But our inability to meet that full demand and to harmonize prices on a global scale is impeded by the amount of LNG export capacity we have here and the amount of LNG import capacity they have there. And both types of plants require billions of dollars to construct and years to permit it and to get online.
So as you look at where we are right now and some of the implications that are inflationary going forward, because let's face it, you know, the Fed's raising interest rates, but the Fed can't create barrels of oil. What they can do is create destruction for barrels of oil by basically putting the economy into a recession. So let's talk about policy and what that might mean. Would that, if the U.S. goes into a recession, and in my opinion, we're in a technical one right now, what would be the implications for the energy markets? Because I don't think people realize how tight they are right now.
Yeah, so an elasticity of demand works both ways. And if we crash the economy hard enough, the price of oil will collapse. And conversely, if we don't and the economy keeps growing, which we would all like to happen, then the price could skyrocket. You are correct in that the Fed cannot print oil. It can't print copper. It can't print steel. It can't print truck drivers. It can't print workers for the oil patch, but it can print dollars. And excess amount of that, you know, easing, quantitative easing and sort of dovish policy from not just the Fed, but from European Central Bank, although they've started to turn a little bit as of today, and then the Bank of Japan and so on. The world has been awash in cheap money. Some would argue that that cheap money is what enabled the production and the miracle in the shale patch. And so if you take away the sort of easy money, then you do take away supply. Look, supply and demand are fluid in the oil and gas industry. The inelasticity of demand is such that small perturbations in either can have disproportionate impacts on price. If the Fed is going to hike into what looks, at least to us, as the beginning of a pretty severe recession, we don't think that oil would be sort of a lone survivor here. I think all assets would crash. If you pull up the chart of the price of oil in the 2008-2009 timeframe, and you overlay that with the NASDAQ, it tells a pretty interesting story.
So if you were looking, given this macro environment, I just see this as a commodity super cycle. We are seeing shortage of low inventories. We're seeing ESG policies and government policies. We're seeing the industry starve for capital. We're seeing hindrance to try to build any new mines or drill for oil. And oil is different. It's not like a manufacturing plant where you just flip on the switch and you start producing widgets again. It takes time to get these things in place to bring a new mine into production or drill a new well.
So the way super cycles end is they destroy demand. And since energy is literally at the heart of the economy, if you don't produce enough primary energy, the price will skyrocket initially until the economy ceases to function. And the only question that we have as analysts and as people who are interested in such markets is at what price will that happen? And so perhaps it was already at $130 Brent that we reached at the last peak. And now that the Fed is hiking, maybe the economy will slow to the point where we can get prices back into the $60 to $80 range or even lower. But saying that we're in a commodity super cycle is akin to saying that we're in a deep energy shortage. And if you're in a deep energy shortage, by extension, you can't grow the economy. And so it's a matter of what is the amount of pain in the form of high energy prices can a society absorb before it collapses? Now, if you're talking true chronic shortages, which is a different deal, then price is irrelevant. And there's no price that can clear the market for Sri Lankan gasoline today because there is none. And so those are sort of two separate things. I don't think the U.S. is going to be like Sri Lanka. We are an energy superpower. I do expect, and we have predicted that the president will make some moves to restrict exports, which will exacerbate price, but will secure some supply for the U.S. in the short term. Over the long term, it's a different issue. But it's a complex thing. There's a lot of flows. I wouldn't say that because of the shortage of energy, it necessarily means that the price of oil is going to go up from here. I guess if that makes any sense.
So as you're looking forward, where we are today, the policies, the macro environment, the geopolitical environment, what things would surprise you the most and what things that would concern you the most from where you're standing today?
So what would surprise me the most is if somehow Europe can find its way through the winter without a true crisis and still have a geopolitical confrontation going with Russia's Putin. I don't know how they square that peg, as they say. If they do not have a peace agreement in the Ukraine and they escalate the sanctions regime and Putin responds by turning off the natural gas, I would be surprised. I don't know how they're going to make it through winter. That's to us, the resolution of the European energy crisis is the single most important geopolitical event in the world today. And we suspect that there will be some form of peace. The Russians are suffering a bit on the battlefield. The European economy is being strangled. This is not a good outcome for anybody, not the least of which the Ukrainians. And so we think that peace could be reached. And by the way, I think we'd see that political price premium in the price of oil, which is probably somewhere $30, $40 a barrel, would evaporate overnight. The price of oil would come down pretty hard on a true peace headline. But what scares me the most would be a complete shutdown of the Nord Stream 1 pipeline that feeds Europe ahead of the winter. That would be disastrous. Also, a large let's say, we had an LNG export facility explode here in Freeport. That's bad for Europe. That's actually good for U.S. consumers because it increases supply here and lowers the price for us as we head into winter. But if we had a major refinery explode and was offline for several months, a cyber attack, a systematic cyber attack on the point sources of our energy infrastructure, which we think would be akin to a declaration of war, that scares us. We're in a very precarious spot. Price is irrelevant when there's no supply, as Sri Lanka is finding out. And we hope Germany doesn't find out those same lessons this winter.
Yeah, these are the things that people aren't thinking through. And unfortunately, I guess one of the bigger concerns, as a lot of these policies fail, as we're seeing, like, it doesn't make sense for Germany to reactivate their coal-fired plants as they shut down reliable nuclear power. But nonetheless, that's where we are today. And I guess the biggest concern is, You can't criticize it. If you call into question the policies and their failures, you're labeled a climate change denier. And we have a tendency, even in the U.S. now, where alternative voices are being shut down or censored.
Yeah, we wrote a piece on this that we made free called Wide Awake. And the sort of social media preview text for that piece was the intoxicating power to nullify people instead of hypotheses has proved irresistible. And we predicted in that piece that sites like ours would be shut down eventually, because soon it will be a form of climate denialism to express an alternative path function to how to get to a lower carbon economy, to criticize the strategy used to get there. And because we have not written about climate change per se, we've written about the fallacy of our responses to this problem. And we suspect soon that won't be okay either. But again, we think, like everything, these things come in cycles. And as people see their standard of living drop, they know the real story. The political upheaval will be real. And hopefully, the political changes needed to put us back on the right path are peaceful, that we don't end up with a sort of strongman type, to use a sort of an old term for a tyrannical leader who is a populist who comes to power and then basically destroys our constitutional system of order. That's more likely to happen in countries like Germany that are about to suffer substantial crushing blows to their standard of living. But it's not something that we should take lightly here either, because if Sri Lanka proves anything, it's the speed of these transitions can be very, very rapid.
So as we close, as we head into the fall, which is a key area, our view is the Fed tends to keep raising things until they break something, either the markets or the economy, and many times both. What would be the key things you would be watching as we head into the fall?
Yeah, so we watch, obviously, the speed with which Freeport LNG will get online. Again, all of this centers around what's going on in Europe, and it flows back here, right? Coal prices are elevated here. We're burning a lot more coal. We're mining a lot more coal. I would watch for whether California agrees to forestall the closing of Diablo Canyon, the last remaining nuclear power plant that I believe is responsible for something like 10% of the state's electricity. These are milestones of sanity that we would see, that we would like to see. We'll see if the president declares a quote-unquote climate emergency and what he would do with his supposed newfound executive powers. The people agitating for a climate emergency are agitating for him to use those powers to shut down fossil fuel production. If he does that, then I would think that's sort of political suicide, especially heading into the midterms. I don't know. The president seems stuck, to be honest with you. I think deep down he's a realist and he knows that these policies are hurting him politically, but he also seems afraid or unwilling to confront the sort of more radical elements of his environmental base. And if he doesn't confront them, then they will be confronted at the ballot box, we suspect.
As we close, why don't you tell our listeners how they can follow you? I find you're writing some of the best on the web.
Thank you very much, Jim. And it was a real pleasure to be here. All of our pieces can be found at doomberg.substack.com, doomberg.substack.com. You can also find us on Twitter. We're active on Twitter. Crossed 130,000 followers last night. Great milestone. We are at Doomberg T, as in team. So Doomberg T on Twitter. And we have lots of imposter accounts, which we take as a compliment. So just make sure you're following the right one. It's a little green chicken. And so, yeah, it's been a real pleasure. Enjoyed it, Jim. And happy to come back anytime. And congrats on the great firm that you've built and all the good work you guys do.
And likewise to you. And I might point out that your launch on Substack was one of the most successful launches that they've had. It's that good. So I'd urge my readers to go check it out. I mean, it's one of the things I read religiously every week. All the best. And it was a pleasure having you on the program and look forward to talking to you again.
Solar cycles, or sometimes they're called sunspot cycles, they've been tracked since about the mid-1700s. And a typical solar cycle will be 11 years from top to bottom. We're now in the 25th solar cycle. Scientists from NASA and the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration previously had estimated that cycle 25 would be similar to cycle 24. However, cycle 25 is emerging as one of the most active in a long time, perhaps even one of the most active on record.
To listen to this full interview, in addition to gaining access to all of our premium content airing during the week, go to financialsense.com and hit the subscribe button.
Financial Sense Wealth Management has been named as one of the top investment advisory firms in the U.S. by the Financial Times. Let us put our financial expertise to work for you. Call now at 888-486-3939 or email grow@financialsense.com. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors, Inc., a registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities, Inc., member FINRA SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
Joining me on the program is Head of Trading and Research at MarketGage, Mish Snyder. Mish, why don't we begin from the top and give us your perspective on this rally. Where do you see this rally going? Do you see it going higher, or are we topping out?
Okay, great question. So let me break it up into parts. When this whole year began, and when we last spoke, of course, we talked about the fact that the market was in a bear market. And I think it was in April. We certainly saw April as a major collapse. And then in June, we kind of bottomed out. And so my feeling has been, and has been for quite some time, that this was the typical type of stagflation environment. And hence, we would see trading ranges in the market. And this is an opportunity for mean reversion traders to really excel, because if you are a buy and holder, obviously, look at the statistics on BlackRock, they have lost nice little money for their clients, $1.7 trillion, the worst 6 months of a start of a year ever. But the people who are more actively trading and are really understanding this sort of extreme where you sell when it goes on to an extreme rally, you buy when it has an extreme dip, have done well. And that is, in essence, the nature of stagflation. And the last time we had that type of environment was in the 70s. So we're really seeing kind of growth, not necessarily slowing to the recessionary fears that many have. And we're certainly not seeing it. When I say growing, we're not really seeing any major growth either, hence stagnation. And then, of course, we still have high inflation, even though many people feel it peaked. So that's kind of where that June low, we actually brought some opportunity, and we had been so heavy in cash, we started buying a few stocks. So now here we are kind of in the middle of the rally. And I think this may be the most difficult place to be for us right here and right now, because what we don't know is this now the start of another leg higher, and we're going to test some higher regions, like if we look at the SPX 4200, are we going to stall here under 4000 and go back down? But what we do know is we have some positives, like you said. Number one is, believe it or not, junk bonds, which is one of the things I watch most carefully, because this is the high yield, high debt companies that will not be invested in hard times or bad times, are actually have not only risen from its lows, but they're actually doing pretty well. They've taken out a little bit of a 2 month consolidation. Do they have a lot more to go? Yes. Does it seem sort of Herculean to think that it can go, let's say, junk bonds, if we look at J&K to 100? Yes. But right now, at this smack dab in the middle, that's one of the positives. Positive two is we have broken out over the 50-day moving average in all of the indices, which we had not been able to do the last time we saw a rally. And we like to look at two major calendar range resets. One is in January, of course, at the beginning of the year. And the other one is in July, which starts the second half of the year. And we have taken out that July calendar range. We like to look at the first 10 trading days of the month. And then once you get that range, which is two simple lines, if you break out above it, that's usually a good sign. Is it 100% consistent? No, but it's a good sign, coupled with the junk bonds, good sign, coupled with the fact that we're over the 50-day moving average and now we're over the six-month calendar range. So if I was just living under a rock from news and looking strictly at the technicals, I would say that there's a good chance that we'll see more. Do I think we're going to be like rallying forever and going to new highs? Absolutely not, because the big difference that we still have in this environment is the Fed, even though it's priced in 75 basis points from here, we still have a situation where in the past that led us to more and more and more growth came really from accommodative Fed policy, zero interest rates, low tax rates, et cetera. And we don't have that situation now. So I'd say we got through step one of at least finding some kind of a tradable bottom. Can we get through step two? Maybe. Will we get to step three? No. I think if we get one more rally from here, that would probably be kind of it. And it would fit really neatly into that stagflation trading range package.
Let's talk about something that is doing well, which is a positive right now, and relating this to the economy, and that's consumer discretionary, which has been breaking out. That's got to be a positive sign. We've seen retail sales. They're looking good. So what's your take on that?
Well, that is one of the positives. I'm glad you brought it up, because that is maybe the lead indicator of all of this. Because let's face it, obviously, we're a consumer economy, 70% of the GDP. And no matter how much we may get screwed up with the strong dollar and higher rates and mortgages applications going down and housing softening, people are still out there buying. And that is good. Now, how long it lasts, of course, is key. So far, gas prices have come off. Food prices, a little bit have come off, not too much, but they still have come off. But really, energy is the big key. So the consumers are staying home more, but they're buying. They're going to restaurants. They're going to shops. The malls are kind of full. So we have to watch that consumer discretionary. And it's a complicated area to watch because it covers a lot of different places. Believe it or not, electric cars are considered, Tesla, Ford are considered consumer discretionary, as is brick and mortar retail and some e-commerce. So we have to see what unfolds. And what might happen is if the consumer basis stays strong, it may really just get narrowed down to certain areas. So hospitality could get better, but it may not go really well because people aren't really wanting to travel much right now because it's so expensive to travel. So if travel comes down, consumer discretionary stays strong, yes, that could be a catalyst at least for another leg up. But I don't think everything just has magically disappeared. All the headwinds, they're still out there. They just have subsided. It's like the calm, almost in a sense, before a storm. I still feel it and I still believe it. But of course, there are things we can look at to see if that does indeed happen.
And speaking of on the inflationary front, we have seen energy prices pull back, the commodities, copper, etc. But I can't help but think that we're in a inflationary environment. Maybe the level has receded somewhat. But I take a look at the policies that they're implementing, everything from the way they're handling energy, the way they're spending money. I still see this as an inflationary environment. What's your take here?
I totally agree with you, Jim. I think that, well, first of all, again, you know, I'm a big student of history, right? And if you go back to, first of all, let's look at the nature of commodities. They're volatile by nature and they can have a 20, 40% move and it's normal. And so I just did a real deep dive into the oil market today. And yes, even though the oil market has come off, and by the way, natural gas hasn't, though, that's still really, really up. But if we just look at crude oil, which is what a lot of commodity traders would look at, right now, the fact is, unless we break like $85 a barrel, then maybe we can make a case for 60. We're just in this sort of trading range. And actually, if you look at the longer term trend, if you look at what I like to look at as a 5 to 6 year trend in oil, we've actually broken out from that. And we're just sort of skidding along that support. So that tells me any catalyst at all could drive those oil prices right back up. The dollar, of course, has been ridiculously strong as some kind of flight to safety, and that has had an impact on no fresh news in the commodities market, but makes you wonder how long that can last. But if we look at oil first, if it gets back over $110 a barrel, I don't think it stops at $130 next time, because it'll mean something happened to ignite it. And let's face it, Jim, we've got major issues all over the world right now. We've got Bangladesh starving. We've got Sri Lanka starving. We have Norway even having food shortages, and oil-rich Norway, right, who's 80%, by the way, into EVs at this point. And God knows what could erupt here in this country. I mean, there's a lot of little bubblings of going on, but right now we're still somewhat in a complacent period, but I always wonder when that changes, if prices get much higher, particularly if the oil prices get much higher. And we have Italy even in a kind of a crisis right now. So it seems to me that Mother Nature, heat, let's just take that. The one thing we can't control, what's going on in Europe right now has happened in the past, but not to the level that it's happening now or the frequency it's happening now. So that could really create some kind of havoc. OPEC is saying that their supplies aren't really there that they used to have. And of course, we still have supply chain, and we have this sort of bizarre labor thing going on in this country. Even though jobless claims went up this week, unemployment numbers are still really good, but yet the labor participation is not great. And we still have like over 10 million jobs that need to be filled in this country with people are saying, well, they don't even want to work. And that's part of a kind of a soft revolution. People are saying, I can't even make enough money to keep up with the cost of inflation. Why even bother to work? Whether it's logical or not, that's something that's also prevailing. So these are all the reasons why geopolitics, Mother Nature, labor, supply chain, all of these factors are still looming out there. And any of them, especially if the dollar starts to go down, could be the next wave of commodities going up. And that would definitely not bode well for the market.
Yeah, the thing that I'm looking at, if you were to tell me, Mish, that we would be looking at 9, 10, 11% inflation rates like the PPI, and that gold would be dropping, you know, I understand the counter relationship with the dollar. But, you know, I've heard people say, well, you know, gold is dropping because the Fed's raising interest rates and people are going into the dollar and treasuries. Well, if inflation is at 8, 9%, why would I put my money in permanently at 3% in a treasury? So what's your take on gold here?
I'm so happy you asked me that question. So I've got two theories on gold. One is that, yes, I mean, really, Jim, most people are not saying what you and I are saying right now. Most people really are 100% convinced that inflation has peaked, that the Fed has done its job and will do a soft landing, and that if anything, we have more of a risk of deflation and recession. So I think that's one thing. Two is you've read, of course, the JP Morgan manipulation of gold that has happened. And it turns out probably other banks have done that as well. And three is you have all of the banks, not just the banks, the Federal Reserve here, but central banks throughout the United States in kind of almost a Bretton Woods-esque type of scenario, which if we go back into history again in the 60s, what was Bretton Woods all about? They were buying the euro and selling the gold to keep the gold prices down and to lift the price of the euro, until that all fell apart. And that's, by the way, when George Soros got all famous, right? Because he was selling the euro into that and he made his $1 billion at that time. So now here we are, fast forward, and it seems like the dollar is not just being bought by the United States in a flight to safety, but all of the European countries, and there's a good reason for it. I mean, obviously, we're 3% yields is better than, well, Europe, which finally raised 0.5% today. But still, they're selling gold and buying the dollar. And I think there's a lot of manipulation there. And one, I'm just looking for that spring to break. We hit 1680, a little bit less in gold as we're speaking. And right now, I think that gold could be bottoming. I've been waiting very patiently. And if that thing starts to unseed, then I think we'll start to see a rally that will really, really be way more than what anybody's expecting, because people have left the precious metals for dead right now. But not me. I'm just waiting patiently. And I've seen this before. I traded gold from 1979 till really basically, still, I still trade gold, not so actively as I used to, but I've seen this volatility before.
Well, you know, the thing that really strikes me is this disconnect between paper in the physical market. And speaking of gold and silver, the premium on Silver Eagles is 74% above spot at Kitco. It's 30% above spot on gold. I had a client that was trying to buy bullion through Kitco, and they called me up and they go, I don't understand. Silver is at almost in the $15 range. Why am I paying these kind of premiums?
Yes. Well, that's all part of this whole scandal that's going on with this manipulation. What people are saying, physical silver, physical gold right now is way better than paper. But, you know how these ratios go. They can get stretched. They can get manipulated to a certain point, and then some catalyst, and then whammo, things go out of control. You know, what's so interesting is I've been talking to a lot of 20-something-year-olds who are big crypto traders, including our very own crypto trader here. And they're all still thinking that the whole financial system at some point, the fiat system and the financial system, the banking system, as we baby boomers know it, is going to be the way of the dinosaur, and that the cryptocurrency is going to be the thing, and even gold won't. Well, that's kind of where we sort of separate, because maybe down the road, 10 years, it could be a different story. But for right now, if you're going to get that kind of a collapse of the financial system, or at least the credibility factor of the financial system under such question, and if the Fed makes any mistakes at all from here, which is so possible, like not get aggressive enough, I'm more worried about that than sending the economy into a recession, then I think that you're going to have not only the cryptocurrencies can go up a lot, but gold can actually go up in tandem. So I feel right now we have the situation where the market could go up, commodities could actually stabilize and start going up. And then at some point that relationship breaks and gold and the commodities continue to go up and the market starts to get a little bit more reality. And we go through another second cycle lower, maybe to about 3,500 in the SPX.
You know, one of the things that I find very attractive, even though you've got 74 and 30% premiums on the bullion, I think a better play here is the actual mining stocks, which have just been hammered hard. And in Mish, some of these stocks, whether you're looking at a Newmont or somehow I'm paying dividends of almost 4%. I mean, in a market where treasuries are below 3%, 4% looks attractive.
Exactly. And you know, it's so funny, Jim, because people ask me all the time, well, what about the dividends in IBM? And what about the dividends in, you know, some of the other typical stock companies that pay good dividends? And I always say to them, well, if the stock is going down, the dividend is not going to make up if you're long the stock. You know, what you're going to lose in your P&L versus what you're going to collect for your monthly checks don't make sense. And that's clearly the case we've got here in Newmont Mines, which made a new low today as we are talking on July 21st. So this, again, this is intriguing to me. There is a disconnect. I also have been watching the miners, particularly the gold miners, so carefully, because very often in the past, gold miners lead a bull market in gold and silver. And right now, Newmont Mines, which is down actually, could be finally saying, you know what, it's exhausted. You know where it landed right now? It landed right on the 200-week moving average. So it's landed into major support, which actually really kind of corresponds with the with what we're saying about the 1680 level in gold per ounce. So yeah, we'll see. I would not take my eyes off of it. Would I be an aggressive buyer? No, but I know some really, really, really smart people who I have tremendous respect for that have been buying little itsy bitsy pieces of gold paper on the way down and are just planning to hold on to it, thinking that within a matter of months, we're going to be seeing 2000 or not higher gold. So we'll see.
So given where you see the markets, we have this possibility we can have a further rally in this next phase, but maybe not to that third phase where it really takes off. Where would you be putting money to work here if you were an investor?
Now, we're talking passive investor or we're talking more nimble?
I would say nimble. Given this market, I think passive has gotten hurt here.
Exactly. I mean, the 60-40 portfolios have gotten killed. Fixed income have gotten killed. I mean, going back to BlackRock. Great question. So right now, like I said, there may be a unique opportunity to get another, 200 points in the S&P, maybe more, in which case I like to look at the things that have actually been outperforming. Interestingly enough, semiconductors have been doing well. Of course, there's the whole scandal about the chip bill and Nancy Pelosi and NVIDIA. But I think that, you know, there may be a little bit more opportunity. The earnings may not be nearly as bad as what we originally expected in Amazon, and Apple's actually done pretty well, maybe NVIDIA. You know, we saw Tesla, which is rallying all day today after its reporting could see its way back up to 900. I like EV space a lot. I just did a whole report on this. There's an interesting statistic about mass adoption and 5%. And in globally, where we have 18 countries that are well over 5% in terms of EV sales and leading to mass adoption, we are just now exceeding 5% here in the United States. So whether it's because of the oil gas prices, whether it's just because more and more car companies are going that way, government intervention has been a big part of why it works so well in other countries, tax incentives, where you don't get tax breaks at all for gas guzzlers, et cetera, et cetera. We are there right now. So I'm very interested, not just in Tesla, but Ford, which reports earnings on July 27th. Hyundai, if you are an over-the-counter type trader, these companies. And then what goes into EVs, the raw materials. We're long copper. It's also gotten beaten up as a commodity. Actually, I have the only metal I have right now in our portfolio is copper. We're looking to maybe get into gold today as we speak, but copper, silver obviously is used also in EVs, maybe some of the rare earth materials. Lithium has been doing very well. So I think if you keep your raw materials buying along with the upcoming trends, that's another area. And then I would keep my eyes very much on biotechnology, medical devices, because they can be non-cyclical. Even if the market goes down, obviously everything gets hit, but they may not get hit as hard. And then finally, because I don't want to give too much, but finally, I've been in China. I think we may have talked about China last time. There's getting little issues, of course, with COVID here and there. But I think we're long some of the tech stocks in China, particularly also JD is one of our holdings. And South Korea. I started doing some research and discovered that South Korea may have been the most undervalued country fund out there. South Korea is number one in innovative technology. They are creating, obviously, EVs with Hyundai and Kia. Their economy is doing fine. I think they just fell out of bed with the strong dollar and everything else that was going on with Asia. And so we're in EWY as the ETF. And we think that can do better. So if you want to trade equities, think nimble. If you want to put on more positions, think either Asian countries that don't have the inflation numbers we have, that have a central monetary central policy that's more accommodative than we're having QT. And then think about the EV space and some of the consumer discretionary that could do well, even if the market doesn't sell off drastically, but kind of stays more stable along with medical stuff.
All right. Well, great stuff, Mish. If our listeners would like to follow the great work that you guys do, tell them how they can easily do so.
Well, I'm on Twitter, very active on Twitter. @MarketMinute is my handle. If you go to marketgage.com, which is our website, sign up for our daily. We give a tremendous amount of good content for free. Almost daily. And then on the weekends, we do an outlook that really goes through all of the different risk factors and then breaks them down to risk on, risk off, and neutral. So just go and sign up for some of our free stuff. Get to know us a little bit. Come talk to me on Twitter and we'll see how it goes. I'm happy to answer any question.
All right. Well, thanks so much for joining us. Have a great rest of the summer and hope to talk to you once again.
Thank you so much, Jim.
You betcha.
That concludes our weekend edition of the Financial Sense NewsHour. To speak with our financial planning and wealth management team, give us a call at 888-486-3939 or go to financialsense.com and click where it says Contact Us. If you aren't already a subscriber to our weekday podcast and would like to listen to more of our content, where we regularly interview book authors, industry experts, and strategists from around the globe, go to Financial Sense and hit the subscribe button. On behalf of Financial Sense NewsHour and the Financial Sense Wealth Management team, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.
Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.